Argument now in the case of Rochelle Waste Disposal against the NLRB.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Josh Vinson on behalf of the petitioner Rochelle Waste Disposal. May it please the Court, this case really implicates two broad issues. One concerns this effort on behalf of the NLRB to consistently shrink the definition of who is a supervisor under the statute, so that we can obviously expand the number of people who can become union members. The second issue that we've raised in this case is one that I think, for lack of a better term, really implicates the standard of review of decisions by an administrative law judge in this context, where we're dealing with the question of determinations made that are obviously very discretionary and take into account credibility questions, but are certainly entitled to a great deal of deference for obvious reasons. But there is a series of cases that this Court has handed down that make it clear that it's not a rubber stamp, and that when we reach the point where the ALJ is not demonstrating a consideration of the entire record and all of the evidence, then maybe the ALJ hasn't...
Sure, that point was reached by 1938.
Well, my point is that they have...
Is this any different from the hundreds of other cases we see in which we learn that there is no ALJ opinion that can ever be long enough to suit an employer?
Well, I understand your point, Judge. But in this particular case, we think that there was some fairly sore thumb evidence, shall we say, that the ALJ overlooked. And this isn't the... I mean, there are cases where this Court has found that to occur. Weiss Memorial, Sears, Falcon, Slusher, those are the handful of instances. I admit there aren't many where the Court was able to identify the fact that the ALJ simply did not consider significant evidence. One example in this case that I think is probably the most significant in the context of an employment case is the point that the ALJ makes that this man, Jarvis, was never warned about what he needed to do in order to avoid termination and to do his job. A pretty significant factor in almost any employment context case. And, of course, this Court's very familiar with them. And in all of the Title VII cases, this issue of a warning to the employee in advance of termination becomes a prominent point, deciding whether there was pretext or not, that sort of thing. And in this case, the other side doesn't even address this point in our briefs, because there was some very significant evidence about a warning. We're talking about a landfill. We're talking about a circumstance where the landfill has applied for a siting application to expand the landfill. Violations that might take place during that period would greatly upset the community. The supervisor, putative supervisor, is warned at the outset that we've had a problem with you using demolition material to cover the waste. At the end of the day, it leaves voids. It creates problems. We've had violations on that score, and we can't have any more violations like that. Very clear evidence. Both the engineer who oversees the landfill explicitly warned or told the supervisor that this was imperative, that we not have any violations. Was also told about a recent inspection that had taken place that had revealed this problem, and that they were engaged in compliance activities with the county in order to rectify the problem. So there was a pretty extensive record made of a warning. And the ALJ's opinion doesn't mention this at all. Simply says, well, the guy was never warned in advance about this problem before he was fired. Now, that, to me, is the kind of example of something that he really should have taken into account.
Let's talk about the record as it relates to Jarvis's role. Where in the record is there evidence that Jarvis could take corrective action against other employees?
Well, the key...
Because the board made a finding that that happened sporadically, not on a regular basis.
Well, you know, this is another problem, the why I talked earlier about this effort on the part of the board to constantly shrink and set standards for what is supervisory activity that become almost impossible to meet. What the board is saying is they're setting a standard here now where unless there is a history of situations where he has disciplined other employees, correctively counseled other employees, if there's not enough of it, then by the fact that it doesn't exist, there is no supervisory activity taking place. It's almost like if he's doing his job well and the employees are performing well, then the employer can never prove that he has the authority because he's never had occasion to discipline or to engage in corrective counseling. Now, in this case, there actually was an instance, and the point that we're trying to make in our appeal here is that there was specific evidence that Jarvis had correctively counseled one of the machine operators who was running a compactor. It's a piece of equipment that shreds the garbage, compacts it down in the smallest possible area, that he could not sit there and idle his machine. He needed to keep it moving constantly in order to consistently compact the garbage. That's part of the job that the equipment operator does. So there's no dispute that he correctively counseled employee on this particular occasion. The specific point that we're concerned with in this appeal is that the regional director construed that activity as misconstrued as disciplinary action. And at the end of 2009, this court came down with the Loperix decision, which said that the board has to be extremely careful about distinguishing corrective action from disciplinary action, because we're back to that point again about shrinking the area of what is supervisor activity. If you call it disciplinary action, now you're double dipping, because the 211 factors, one of the other 211 factors other than responsible direction, is disciplinary action. So you can't make disciplinary action part of the definition of responsible direction. It has to be something other than disciplinary action. And Loprecht said you've got to make it clear that you're not considering whether someone can engage in discipline in order to satisfy the test of responsible direction. You have to show that they were able to engage in some act of corrective counseling, corrective action, which a subtle difference, but a difference nonetheless, according to Loprecht. When you look at page 847 of our appendix, in the regional director's decision, you can see that he characterizes the act of telling the equipment operator not to idle his machine and had to keep it moving as an instance of discipline. And so you see him using the term discipline and corrective action interchangeably. And that's a legal error. That's a legal error under Loprex. And that's one of the reasons why we think that this decision should not be enforced, the refusal to bargain case. And that's not the only instance. You know, to be more specific, responding to your question.
What are instances where he exercised his independent judgment?
You know, in the operation of a landfill, you're actually engaged in sort of the construction of a building, piece by piece. You're building a structure, a mountain of garbage. And it, according to the law, which this gentleman is certified under, he's certified as a landfill supervisor by the state of Illinois, has to take a test to do it. One of the things that must be achieved is a certain amount of mass stability so that the entire building stays in its place just like a regular structure would. And so part of that exercise of independent judgment is deciding where the roads will be built in order for garbage trucks to get to and from the cells where they drop the garbage. How the different slopes and grades will be created as different lifts of garbage are created and compacted in order to achieve the mass stability. I mean, you've got equipment operators who are spreading it, compacting it, shredding it. But the supervisor's role, and this is the why, I mean, this is why part of this decision that the regional director reached in this case makes the whole certification law in Illinois absurd, is he has to exercise that sort of judgment. You know, it's maybe it's not the kind of judgment we exercise as attorneys and professionals, but it's the kind of judgment that someone who runs a landfill has to exercise, and that is, where do you start the next lift of garbage? Where does it have, what grade does it have to be at? Is the slope too small so that it's taking up too much area and you're using it up, or is the slope too steep that it's not going to be stable and your equipment isn't going to be able to operate on it? This is the type of direction and judgment that he has to exercise each day as this occurs.
Does anybody sign off on his decisions?
Not on that context. And that's the other issue that I have a problem with here, with the board's manner of trying to constrict this analysis. You know, they say, well, everything he did was subject to oversight by the owner, Gelderloos. And the problem with that is that, yes, there was testimony that for certain special projects, Gelderloos approved. But in terms of the day-to-day operation, no, he did not require that type. And besides that, this would set up a circumstance where virtually no person who's a supervisor could ever be a supervisor unless they were at the top of the organization, because everyone in the chain of command eventually has someone who has the right to either accept or reject a particular decision they may make. So again, when you're talking about this ongoing effort by the board to continuously shrink, you know, who is a supervisor, they've boiled it down now to the point where unless you're the CEO of the company and nobody can overrule you, you're not a supervisor.
Well, did the company put any evidence in the record to show what was meant by directing or supervising under the state's EPA regulations, or that those terms have the same meaning as they have under the Act?
We did not view the question of what the meaning of the terms under the certification law to be a matter subject to evidentiary proof.
I mean, there was no evidence put in on that?
Well, there's evidence that he directs the work. I mean, certainly there was a lot of evidence of that, much of what I just described in terms of his day-to-day activities. But in terms of whether the certification law, which says that you must have a responsible person on site to direct the work, no, as a matter of statutory construction as to whether the certification law in Illinois, which says he has to be there and responsible to direct the work, means the same thing as responsibly direct under Section 211 of the Act. Now, to me, that's a question of law, not a question of proof.
So you're saying that just because he held the license, and the license states that the holder is responsible for directing landfill operations, it automatically follows that he has a responsibility in every situation and under every employer to direct the work?
No, I don't say that's automatic. Okay, what I do say is that with respect to having that license and the fact that there's a potential penalty, the loss of the license, if he doesn't do his job, and that the owner testified that if he lost the license because of that, I would terminate him, that sets up an instance where there could be adverse consequences to him for failing to carry out the duties that the certification obligates him to carry out. I don't think it's quite, I wouldn't call it automatic, but I also don't think it's fair for the board to just dismiss this as simply mere paper authority. That's all the regional director did. He said, this is mere paper authority. And I'm not saying that there can't be circumstances where there are going to be rules or policies that an employer might have that are a sham and are mere paper authority, just designed to make someone look like a straw boss. But that's not what the certification law is about. I mean, I think there's a reason that Illinois has a law that you have to have somebody on site who is certified to be responsible for directing the work and who will suffer consequences if there isn't. And in this case, the employer made it clear that if that happened, he would terminate this man if he lost his license. So I think those consequences are there with the independent judgment. I think I'll save what time I may have left for rebuttal, if there is any, unless there's other questions.
Mr. Vincent?
Thank you.
Mr. Seid.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Seid for the Labor Board. In rejecting the company's attempts to exclude the deciding voter, Mr. Jarvis, in the election, the board reasonably found that the company has not shown by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have discharged Mr. Jarvis absent his protected activity, nor has it carried its burden of showing that Mr. Jarvis was a supervisor who would have been ineligible to vote. With respect to the discharge, very simply, three salient points. The company has asserted that it discharged Mr. Jarvis due to his actions at an incident that occurred at the landfill on January 13, 2007. Yet, it doesn't dispute that it never told him at the time of the discharge that this was the reason for why he was being let go. Second, the company conceded at the hearing that if only another pro-union employee had accepted a transfer to a different position, it would have been willing to keep Mr. Jarvis on the job. That's something that the company has never tried to address, and there really is no good answer for it to address in its briefs. And then third, it also acknowledged that it would have considered Mr. Jarvis for future employment, wholly inconsistent with a claim that it discharged him based on poor job performance, particularly for an incident that had occurred in January of 2007. With respect to the company's burden to establish that Mr. Jarvis was a supervisor, the company has not disputed the applicable test for the one indicia of supervisory status that it has alleged before this court, that Mr. Jarvis responsibly directed employees. Under that test, it needed to show both that there was accountability and that the accountability was done in a manner in which he exercised independent judgment. As far as accountability, there has to be showing that Mr. Jarvis corrects the work of other employees, and two, that he himself would be held accountable by the company. Company counsel referred to a situation about the running of a machine. Yet the two examples that were given, and the other example that were given at the hearing, specifically by Mr. Gelderloos, was that he told Mr. Jarvis what to tell another employee based on what Mr. Gelderloos had observed happening at the landfill. And that can be found in the representation hearing at pages 352 to 356. And it's also in appendix page 15. And then the company also had to show that Mr. Jarvis would be held accountable for the job performance of other employees. Very simply, at the first representation hearing, the representation proceeding at pages 79, 82, and 83, Mr. Gelderloos was specifically asked whether he would hold Mr. Jarvis accountable for the job performance of the other employees. He said no. So the company has not passed an initial hurdle of showing accountability, and then it even would have a second hurdle to establish of showing independent judgment, which it also is not shown here, given the very strict state regulations, the fact that Mr. Gelderloos, who also held a license, was on site every day instructing Mr. Jarvis some of the things that needed to be done at the landfill on each particular day, and the fact that there's a very experienced workforce and there's ample testimony that the employees knew on a day-to-day basis how to perform their job, and that Mr. Jarvis spent most of his time operating the machinery and doing a lot of maintenance work. And unless this court has any further questions, it would simply ask that the court uphold the board's order and direct the company to recognize and to bargain with the union.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Vincent?
The one thing that Mr. Side keeps focusing on in his argument are the credibility issues, and I'm not here to argue credibility issues in this case about why he was terminated. That's a lost cause. I'm talking about whether the ALJ considered all of the evidence, and when we talk about what evidence he didn't look at, you know, there's another example of the question of how serious the violation was here. The ALJ passes off what happened on this occasion where they were cited as typical of other violations that the landfill had experienced, and that's just completely wrong. The record shows the exact opposite, that this was a situation where they had previously had notices of violation, but not citations and threats of enforcement action, which is what occurred after the incident that led to Mr. Jarvis's discharge. ALJ doesn't discuss that evidence at all, completely overlooks it. I guess the only other point I'd urge the court to take a close look at is this question, this last one that Mr. Side pointed out, and that is that issue about whether the supervisor is accountable for the job performance of other employees. Because to me, there's a difference between being accountable for the job performance of other employees and being accountable for your own job performance, suffering adverse consequences for failing to direct what the other employees do. And again, I think this is an example of a misreading of Oakwood Healthcare and a misreading of what responsible direction means. It's a subtle difference, but it's an important distinction between, you know, whether Jarvis ever was disciplined because somebody else didn't do their job, which to me is not an example of responsible direction under the statute. Responsible direction means that you are held accountable for your own failure to do your job. And in that case, that would be making sure that the employees do theirs. So for Mr. Side to point out that we didn't introduce evidence that Jarvis was disciplined because of for the job performance of other employees is completely beside the point. And if that is part of the basis of the regional director's decision in this case on supervisory status, that is a misinterpretation of law under Oakwood Healthcare. And if Oakwood Healthcare is saying that that's the standard, then that's wrong too, and this court ought to fix that, because in terms of the adverse consequence side, that's what it should be, is responsibility for your own action, not that of others. Thank you. Sorry.
Mr. Vincent. The case is taken under advisement.